This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. Russian President Vladimir Putin took Belarus strongman Alexander Lukashenko for a boat trip in the Black Sea near Sochi on Saturday. The close allies met for a second day and held so-called informal talks amid the outcry after Belarus diverted a European plane. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Saturday's talk centered on economic cooperation and the COVID-19 pandemic. But he says they also spoke of last Sunday's events when Belarus scrambled a military jet to divert a Ryanair plane and arrest journalist Roman Protasevich and his Russian girlfriend on board. Lukashenko provided his counterpart detailed information about what happened aboard the aircraft, according to Peskov. The United States on Friday announced punitive measures targeting Belarus, while the European Union urged EU-based carriers to avoid its airspace and has promised fresh sanctions. A shadow government in Myanmar said Saturday it is seeking to reverse the February 1st coup and has joined forces with a rebel group to, quote, demolish junta rule. Myanmar has been in turmoil since the military overthrew Aung San Suu Kyi and her government and launched a brutal crackdown. A group of ousted lawmakers later set up a shadow national unity government seeking to bring anti-coup dissidents together with Myanmar's many ethnic rebel fighters to form a federal army to challenge the junta. The unity government said in a statement Saturday the rebel Chin National Front signed an agreement to, quote, demolish the dictatorship and to implement a federal democratic system in Myanmar. In recent years, its fighters have dwindled, so experts say it's more of a symbolic move, but does align the unity government with well-respected peace negotiators. This is VOA News. The Democratic Republic of Congo's government said Saturday the eruption of a second volcano it had announced hours earlier was a false alarm, the scare coming a week after Mount Nyiragongo roared back to life, causing devastation and sparking a mass exodus. The eastern city of Goma has lived in fear since Nyiragongo's eruption, with rolling aftershocks and the evacuation of around 400,000 residents turning attention towards a looming humanitarian crisis. The government had said a different volcano had a low-intensity eruption on Saturday morning, sending lava flowing into an uninhabited area. However, the communications ministry then issued another statement saying false alarm on Nyamiragura. It says the plane confirmed no eruption, just smoke from regular volcanic activity. A coronavirus surge sweeping through Thailand's prisons has thrown the spotlight on the kingdom's overcrowded penal system, where some inmates say they have less space to sleep than the inside of a coffin. Authorities claim as of Saturday, almost 25,000 people have tested positive inside jails, where inmates have been encouraged to keep wearing masks even while they sleep. Officials have floated plans to give early releases to prisoners with underlying medical conditions and have announced funding for more testing and medical care in recent days. But former inmates say those behind bars have been kept in the dark about the seriousness of the outbreak. Infections in Thai prisons have skyrocketed from just 10 publicly announced cases a month ago to nearly 25,000 on Saturday. France will work alongside African nations to vaccinate 40% of the continent's population by the end of this year, French President Emmanuel Macron said on Saturday during an official visit in Pretoria. He says as long as everywhere isn't vaccinated, everyone is exposed to a risk because that means the epidemic could continue to spread. Macron gave a speech to a French community in South Africa on the last day of an official trip. He said Friday France would invest in boosting the production of COVID-19 vaccines in Africa to help close a gap in the availability of the shots between African and Western nations. And Indonesian officials say a ferry in the eastern part of the country caught fire early Saturday with nearly 200 people on board, forcing passengers and crew to jump into the sea but causing no casualties. All 181 passengers, including 22 children and 14 crew members, were rescued and safely evacuated to a nearby island, according to a sea official. He says the agency's rescue operation also involved local fishing boats that happened to be in the area. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
The commander-in-chief himself, who made promises during his campaign to lead from the front, that it will provide the necessary impetus that will enable General Yahaya to succeed.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari appoints Major General Farouk Yahaya as the new chief of army staff.
I know across there are some NRM people that really desire to see a better Uganda, and over the years, their numbers have not gone down, but ours have gone up too. So we shall be able to really work the files and be able to, over time, cultivate common ground for the sake of posterity and for the sake of our people.
Uganda's main opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, select attorney Mathias Mpuuga as minority leader in parliament.
The same opposition political parties that today claim that the Electoral Commission of Zambia is not doing its work, the Electoral Commission of Zambia is under siege, are the same people that boycotted the process.
And Zambia's President Edgar Lungu launches his re-election bid for a second full-year term. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, President Muhammadu Buhari has appointed Major General Farouk Yahaya as the new Chief of Army Staff. He replaces Lieutenant General Ibrahim Ataeru, who recently died in a plane crash while on assignment in Kaduna last week. Political analysts say the newly appointed Army Chief faces a daunting task to help bolster security across the country. This following reports of increasing insecurity. It includes kidnappings, banditry and violence carried out by herdsmen and Islamic militant groups such as Boko Haram. For reaction to the appointment of the new Army Chief as well as reports of growing insecurity, I reach Kola Ologbodiyan, spokesperson for the Nigerian main opposition PDP, the People's Democratic Party.
For us in the People's Democratic Party, we are currently understudying the new appointment, particularly as it concerns the training and the experience of the officer that has just been appointed. And until then, our hope is that General Yahaya will be able to fit into the system and rescue our nation from all forms of insecurity.
What are the expectations of the PDP for this Army Chief following report of growing insecurity across the country?
The expectation of the People's Democratic Party is that General Yahaya will be able to ensure that the spate of insecurity in our country is reduced to a bearable level. Our expectation is that he will be able to mobilize men and resources, officers and other ranks, in a manner that will help our country to come out of our current spate of insecurity. We also expect him to boost the morale of men and officers who are on the harm's way in front so that they can protect the citizenry of our nation. As we speak, the spate of insecurity in our country, Nigeria, is alarming, and it appears that the government in office has abandoned Nigerians to their fate. So we believe that with a new entrant of General Yahaya into the realm of asymmetry war that we are confronted with as a people, that his tenure will make a difference.
Supporters of the government are saying that General Yahaya has the pedigree and the experience
to carry out the president's mandate to protect life and property and sharply reduce the growing insecurity across the country. How confident are you that he'll be able to undertake this enormous task following what many people see as a challenging security situation in Nigeria?
We're not going to be swayed by the comments of the supporters of Mr. President, because in time past, they have always looked for adjectives to lay claims to the capacity of the administration of President Muhammadu Buhari in spite of its failures. However, it is our prayer as a political party that General Yahaya will be able to deliver on the expectations of Nigerians, which is to safeguard our nation and her territories. As far as we are concerned, we are Nigerians and we have no other country than this. But we also look forward to the commander-in-chief himself, who made promises during his campaign to lead from the front, that it will provide the necessary impetus that will enable General Yahaya to succeed.
Overall, supporters of the ruling party have praised the government and by extension President Muhammad Buhari's effort to fighting the insecurity in the country, including releasing abducted and kidnapped, in some cases, school children, unarmed civilians, among others. Why do you disagree with these efforts to restore confidence in the Nigerian population by the effort of the government to bolster security in Nigeria?
It is absolutely incorrect for any Nigerian to say that President Muhammadu Buhari has a pass mark in fighting insecurity. We do not know those whom the government have rescued from the arms of kidnappers or insurgents or the Boko Haram. We have a situation that a journey of 2 hours has become a nightmare to Nigerians because of kidnappers. We have a situation in which parents are scared of sending their pupils to school because of fears of kidnappers.
Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for the Nigerian Main Opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. In Uganda, the main opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, has chosen attorney Mathias Mpuuga as its minority leader in parliament Friday. The NUP takes over as the main opposition party in parliament following the recent general election. The Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, had previously been the party with the biggest number of opposition parliamentarians. But this year's election saw the NUP winning more seats in parliament, which enables the party to choose representatives to lead the opposition in the Ugandan lawmaking body. Mathias Mpuuga is a lawyer and a parliamentarian who has had a long working relationship with the FDC and other opposition lawmakers. He is also a vice president of the NUP and a sharp critic of President Yoweri Museveni and his ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM. For more reaction to his choice as the newly installed minority leader in parliament, I reached Mathias Mpuuga in the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
I was humbled to be selected by colleagues to lead the opposition parliament. So the exercise was complete. We also selected and agreed on to the members who will lead the critical accountability committees in parliament that the opposition leads. They've also been constituted, as well as members that will represent the party on international delegations where parliament of Uganda is a member.
As now the newly chosen leader of the opposition in parliament, what makes you uniquely qualified to unite the opposition in parliament so your priorities are observed in the lawmaking body in Uganda?
I have worked with a majority of these colleagues, and I have mentored many of them. Probably they have looked at my work, my commitment, my deep understanding of the challenge at hand, and zeroed on me to lead them, and it humbles me. It's not that we had a deficit of other able leaders in the party, but for this time around, colleagues thought that I would lead the front line for the opposition parliament.
Are you going to be working with the other opposition parties, including the Forum for Democratic Change, a party that you have worked closely with for a long time, that has held leadership position of the minority in parliament for some time now?
Very true. I've worked closely with the FDC for the last 15 years, the last 10 years in parliament, but also other years outside parliament. And I have the full appreciation and admiration of their commitment. I have, and I will continue to engage in discussions formally with their leadership. We have formally contacted them to propose members we can work with on the shadow government. And we look forward, probably by end of next week, they would have given us their preferences for inclusion in the shadow government, as well as the my former party, the Democratic Party, and the Ugandan People's Congress. We look forward to working with them because the desire to form a common front needs no further explanation.
What should Ugandans expect from the leadership, the minority leadership in parliament?
I would like to assure Ugandans that ours is a front that is destined to further the frontiers of democratic space. You do realize that over the years, the regime has been working to stifle democratic space by passing legislation that makes it impossible for us to operate, by stifling the opposition and buying off the opposition. We're going to do our best to try and undo some of this legislation over this common front. And we believe this front, once worked on together, we shall be able to propel the space for human rights, one of the endangered ethos of our democracy, so that over the years, as the parliament of the people, as a platform of the people's consensus, which is parliament, we are able to expand democratic space to engender an enduring democracy over the years coming for Uganda, because we are servants of the people that are suffering the effects of lack of space. The last election was a very, very premature election. Lives were lost because over the years we haven't agreed on key democratic principles and variables that are acceptable in a free and democratic society. So legislation to undo some of the bad laws, as well as pushing for more liberal working space for our democracy, are enshrined.
Some people are suggesting that the minority, and for that matter, your leadership, they don't expect any significant impact in parliament due to what they say is the dominance of the ruling NRM, the NRM party in parliament. How do you respond to such expectation or lack of expectation from some supporters of the NRM?
I believe the minority presents a higher quality, and if arguments were to win the day, we probably have a better representation on that platform. Certainly, the first majority commanded by the ruling party is a huge disadvantage and an anti-democratic number. We should try to cajole and work and speak to some of the minds in there. I know across there are some NRM people that really desire to see a better Uganda, and over the years, their numbers have not gone down, but ours have gone up too. So we shall be able to really work the files and be able to, over time, cultivate common ground for the sake of posterity and for the sake of our people.
Mathias Mpuuga is the newly installed minority leader in Uganda's parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Zambia's President Edgar Lungu has launched his re-election bid for a second full-year term. This, despite legal challenges to his candidacy ahead of the upcoming August 12 general election. Zambians go to the polls in August to choose a new president and parliament. The incumbent president is expected to face a stiff challenge from Hakainde Hichilema, leader of the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND. Analysts say the power of incumbency and the issue of infrastructural development could boost the president's re-election prospects.
However, opposition supporters say the president and his administration have overborrowed and failed to repay the loans. They say their policy is putting pressure on the economy and is impoverishing Zambians. They are calling on Zambians to reject the president and his governing Patriotic Front, or PF, at the polls. For more on the prospects of the president's re-election bid, I reach Antonio Mwanza, media director for the ruling party.
Clearly, the president stands a 70% chance of winning the election because of what the Patriotic Front has delivered in the last 10 years. We have outperformed our own vision in very critical sectors of the economy. We have revamped the transport and telecommunication sector of the country, making it easy for people to move from one place to the other. We have interconnected the entire country. We have invested billions upon billions of United States dollars in the energy sector, and we have lighted up all cities, all districts, all provinces, and people today can do different businesses because they have got electricity available. And we've created more jobs and more opportunities for young women and youth, and we have put Zambia at a space where now today we can say going into the future, we expect more Zambians to be at the center of the economic development. We expect more Zambians to go into agro and processing businesses. We expect Zambians to have a larger stake in the mining sector.
Antonio Mwanza, critics of the president say there has been overborrowing and the debt burden is crushing the Zambian economy. Coupled with the coronavirus pandemic, it looks like the president stands rather a 50% chance of winning or a 50% chance of losing to his main challenger, Hakainde Hichilema. What are your thoughts?
We needed to borrow in order to inject $3 billion in the energy sector so that we can produce enough power to supply not only Zambia, but also to be in a position to export. And power is a very important fundamental basic requirement for any country to develop. You need electricity. And we needed to borrow to build this infrastructure that has become a cornerstone for economic development, because now people have got housing, people have got access to electricity, access to water, access to telecommunication, and they are able to put up factories, they are able to put industries, and they are able to produce and grow the economy. So if you look at what we have done with the money that we borrowed in order to invest in the infrastructure that is necessary for economic development. We did not borrow for consumption. On the other hand, the other gentleman stands no chance to win an election.
Antonio, some of the president are saying he's developed dictatorial tendencies and being hypocritical for banning public rallies when he made the announcement banning public rallies at a huge public rally. How do you respond to such criticism?
The correct position is that when the president was launching the 2021 campaign, we did that in compliance with all the COVID-19 guidelines as prescribed by the Minister of Health. And also, even when the president was having nominations, he only went with 14 people in line with the COVID-19 guidelines. I want to be quick to mention that the president's directive is not that he has banned the rallies, but in fact, the president has asked the police and the Ministry of Health officials to enforce a ban on public rallies that has been there for the last 1 year. And so the president is only being responsible. As a leader, he must be responsible and make sure that we put the lives and the safety of the Zambian people first before the elections and the campaigns.
Some people have criticized the Electoral Commission of Zambia of not being truly independent, and that the officials there seem to be responding to the whims and caprices of the Patriotic Front and by extension the government, making the upcoming elections pretty much unreliable and might not necessarily be credible or transparent. How do you respond to that?
Here are the facts. Number one, they have failed to substantiate any of those claims that they have raised against the Electoral Commission of Zambia. They have been passing blanket, sweeping statements against the commission. The Electoral Commission of Zambia stands out to be one of the most credible institutions in the whole of Africa, and it's been an example of an institution that has constantly run and managed free, fair, and credible elections. And just to top it up, the Constitution of the Republic of Zambia is very explicit that the Electoral Commission of Zambia does not get any instructions or directives from anybody. Not even the president has the authority to direct the Electoral Commission of Zambia of what to do. Secondly, the president of the Republic of Zambia, Dr. Edgar Chagwalungu, had started a process of reforming our electoral system by proposing to have amendments to the major pieces of legislation that governs the Electoral Commission of Zambia. That includes the Electoral Commission of Zambia Act, as well as the Electoral Process Act number 35 of 2016. And the same opposition political parties that today claim that the Electoral Commission of Zambia is not doing its work, the Electoral Commission of Zambia is under siege, are the same people that boycotted the process.
Antonio Mwanza is the media director for the Zambian ruling party, the Patriotic Front, or PF. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Conflict and insecurity are affecting stability and economic development in parts of Africa. And in some countries, including Nigeria and Ethiopia, fighting is harming food production. From the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, Samuel Okocha reports.
Recently, the Nigerian military announced it is investigating claims that Abubakar Shekau, the leader of the militant Islamic group Boko Haram, died in northeast Nigeria. An internal report by the country's intelligence agency said the militant commander died after he detonated explosives during a fight with forces of the Islamic State's West Africa province in the Sambisa forest. Even if Shekau is dead, the insecurity rocking the region may still be far from over, says Stan Labo, a security consultant and retired army colonel.
Well, I'm not seeing anything drastically happen this soon as winning the war. But we believe 70% of the war has been won without him, because he's the commander. He sum up all whatever strategy operations, whatever they carried out is through him. But I believe there's still more to be done, because now they'll be coming out from the hideout with all manners of attacks and different strategies.
Boko Haram attacks have left 30,000 people dead, with more than 2 million people displaced from their homes in Nigeria and neighboring countries. But Boko Haram is not the only security challenge facing Nigeria. Clashes between farmers and herders remain a problem, and this has curbed food production across the country, says Prince Wale Oyekoya, an agriculturist and former head of agriculture at the Lagos Chamber of Commerce and Industry.
And the insecurity is in all the geopolitical zones of the country, and it has really affected the food production in the country, especially in the middle belt, like Benue State, where the herdsmen are killing the farmers. So we are fighting so many wars in Nigeria that it really affected the foodstuff.
Last month, Nigeria's National Bureau of Statistics announced that food inflation has accelerated at the highest pace in 15 years, compounding the despair of many households. Prince Oyekoya says food prices have jumped partly because political violence is affecting farmers.
A cassava now is like a gold, it's something that is very easy to plant in Nigeria, and even maize, which is supposed to be a staple food with the rice, is very, very expensive in the market. Most of the farmers, they don't want to go to the farm to farm. And that is why most of the prices of the foodstuffs have really gone up. So the insecurity is really affecting the food security of the country. And if care is not taken, I hope and I don't pray that our citizens will be eating from the dustbin or from the garbage.
Nigeria is not the only country where conflict is threatening food security. In Ethiopia, fighting between the federal government and forces of the Tigray regional government militias has affected agriculture, a major source of livelihood for the population. The Tigray Agricultural Bureau estimates that 1.3 million hectares of crops have been damaged. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs estimates about 5.2 million people, about 93% of Tigray's population, requires emergency food assistance. Analysts say Africa is moving forward in efforts to improve food security, including dramatically reducing barriers between the continent's food producers and markets with the African Continental Free Trade Area, But they warn that even the potentially far-reaching trade bloc will be limited if the continent cannot bring an end to decades of insecurity and conflict. Samuel Okocha, VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Namibia, President Hage Geingob and First Lady Monica Geingob have both tested positive for the coronavirus. In a press statement, the government says the first couple were informed about their test results Wednesday. It further states that the president and his wife have been resting since entering into isolation. Local media reports say the news appears to have shocked the country. The reports say misinformation and conspiracy theories persist despite efforts of the government to vaccinate the population and to ensure citizens adhere to medical guidelines to limit the spread of the disease. Some analysts say the announcement of the test results of the president and his wife could help dispel some of the misinformation and myths surrounding COVID-19. For reaction, I reach Philia Nangolo, executive director of Namibia Rights, the country's largest human rights organization.
A lot of Namibians are really, vaccine hesitant. And because of what has been going on, you know, I tend to think perhaps this came all the way from the United States of America during the Trump era, when people were really, they don't want to believe that this is a serious virus. So there has not really been much reaction to that because a lot of people really don't believe it.
What do you think is the impact this news will have on the people of Namibia?
Those who really believe that this virus is deadly, is bound to kill a lot of people if you are not taking measures, then, it's really bad. I think a lot of people are now going to get vaccinated. But on the other hand, there has been quite a lot of vaccine hesitancy because people really don't believe that this virus is a serious one and it can be taken then seriously as such. That's the problem.
But Phil, why are they so doubtful about the disease itself? Because there are reports of deaths in Namibia attributed to the coronavirus. And some people are saying that it appears that misconceptions and misinformation seem to be making way significantly in parts of the country. Why is this so?
Yeah, I believe it's perhaps a time like that. There has been quite a lot of propaganda by these conspiracy theorists. I think all the way from the U.S. through social media, YouTube, WhatsApp, and all these. By the way, on the other side as well, our society is still, for the lack of good word, primitive. They believe that this disease or whatever, it's not really a serious one. It is a conspiracy by whites to kill Africans.
Are people satisfied with the efforts of the government to educate people about the dangers of the disease and the need to protect themselves?
It looks like a lot of them are think that they are just forced to wear masks because the government wants to put them down. The government wants to restrict them, and they really don't want that. Yeah, you can see by quite a lot of people who have, the number of people who have so far been vaccinated, about 60, maybe 64,000 by now, that is a very low number. So you can really see that the work of these conspiracy theorists like QAnon and quite a lot of people, we have people here in our country now calling themselves patriots, and people are told, this virus is just a Chinese conspiracy, and through the government, the government wants to restrict their rights, and they think it's not true at all.
Do you anticipate attitudinal changes or perhaps a shift in strategy following reports that both the president and the first lady have contracted or tested positive to the coronavirus?
Yes, indeed. I do. And positively so, because when the vaccines, for example, were introduced, very few people took to the hospitals, to the centers to get vaccinated. And that was about March. Now you can see that a lot of people are really getting vaccinated. There are about 63,000, if perhaps not 64,000, who have been vaccinated. I think the fact that the government has announced that the president and the first lady have contracted the disease, a lot of people are now really going to take it seriously, and they will take it to the health centers to get vaccinated as well.
Philia Nangolo is the executive director of Namibia Right, the country's largest human rights organization. He spoke with me from the capital of Vinton. Still in Namibia, Vikuyi Rukoru, the current paramount chief of the Herero people, is dismissing an agreement between the German government and the administration in Windhoek as unacceptable. He says the agreement fails to address demands for reparations for the atrocities Germany committed against its people and the Nama ethnic group over 100 years ago. This after the German government officially admitted Friday to committing genocide against the Nama and the Herero ethnic groups during colonial times. Tens of thousands of Herero and about 10,000 Nama were killed, tortured, or driven into the desert for rebelling against German rule. Local media reports that under the terms of the agreement, Germany will provide 30 years of financial assistance to improve infrastructure, healthcare, and training programs for the two ethnic groups. They have been demanding an official apology and financial reparations over what they say was the genocide committed against them. German officials say the agreement is a form of reconciliation, but not legally binding reparations. For reaction to the agreement between the government in Berlin and Windhoek, I reached Vikoye Rukoru, a lawyer, businessman, and the current paramount chief of the Herero people.
We are extremely unhappy about this agreement for many reasons, principally because the agreement is a product of discussions between the two governments. It's a product of negotiations about us, but which excluded us from the word go. And that is obviously something totally unacceptable. It's not in line with international legal principles set out by the United Nations on matters of genocide and reparation, which dictate that on matters of genocide and reparation, indigenous people are entitled to be represented by their own self-appointed representatives, separate and distinct from representatives of their own government. Secondly, the content of the agreements, of the agreement itself. There's no way in that agreement where Germany categorically acknowledges that what actually happened to our ancestors way back in the 1900s actually constitute a crime of genocide.
Why are the Nama and the Herero people adamant about the definition of genocide? Because the German government acknowledged that it committed genocide during the colonial era occupation of Namibia.
So it does not, with respect. Germany is playing with words, but their game with words have practical implications. Germany has been refusing for 6 years during their negotiations with the Namibian government to acknowledge that they have committed genocide. Is understood by the rest of the world. They attach a special definition to genocide specifically because they don't want to pay reparations. Genocide everywhere follows the payment of reparations. They intend, in terms of this agreement, read it carefully, they say they have a gesture. You know what a gesture is? It's a token of goodwill out of their own heart, not because they feel an obligation, a legal right, have decided to give, quote-unquote, as part of their statement, support for social or development projects. Support for development projects. Is that equal to reparations?
What is your next line of action about this? Are you teaming up with the other ethnic group to fight this, since the agreement is between the government in Windhoek and Germany?
Well, the government in Windhoek has become a client state of, and has been a client state of, the Berlin government over the last 30 years, dependent on Germany's bilateral assistance, beholden to them, and therefore clearly not representing the interest of its own citizens. Our struggle for reparations will continue. We will now escalate our struggle to at the international level. We will take it to the international fora of the United Nations, the AU, the United States Congress, yes, to Mr. Biden. After all, genocide is a crime against humanity. We would want these institutions and these world powers to come and appreciate that what has happened to us is a crime against humanity, that Germany must be treated as a pariah state.
Is your kingdom or are your people pushing for legal redress in spite of the agreement between the German government and your government in Namibia?
Yes, we have, as of the 16th of April last month, we have filed our appeal with the United States Supreme Court, and we are pushing for a legal fight there, concurrent with our political and diplomatic struggles to get restorative justice, social justice, and dignity for our people.
Vikui Rikoro is a lawyer, businessman, and the current paramount chief of the Herero people. He spoke with me from the Namibian capital, Windhoek. The UN Refugee Agency says it has received reports that hundreds of young people have been abducted by soldiers from displacement camps in the town of Shire in northern Tigray. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Community sources report Eritrean and Ethiopian soldiers stormed several camps for internally displaced people Monday evening and forcibly detained more than 500 young men and women. Spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency, Baba Baluch, says the soldiers reportedly took away the young people in vehicles. He says the situation is traumatic and distressing, not only for relatives of the missing, but for all displaced communities living in Shire.
There's a lot of anxiety and fear among the community. Many of the displaced communities have been approaching us. We have an office in Shire where people have come kind of being really worried about the whereabouts of their loved ones.
Shire is the capital city of the northwestern zone of Tigray. It was the site of mass extrajudicial killings on February 15th. Ethiopian and Eritrean defense forces reportedly were complicit in that massacre. Tigray has been engulfed in war since Ethiopia launched an offensive against the Tigray People's Liberation Front on November 4th. The United Nations says thousands of people have been killed and about 2 million have been forced to flee their homes. Baluch says his agency got in contact with the Ethiopian authorities as soon as staff became aware of developments.
And we continue to raise the urgent concern for safety of those who have been removed. As you mentioned, some have been released, but there are others that are still being detained and or kept. We're still worried about them as well.
Baluch says authorities have indicated more may be released in coming days. He says the UNHCR will continue to follow the situation closely. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection. For that, I want to say a big shout out to Dr. Osman Boachi, General Physician, Jacinta, and the entire management of HealthNet Airport Medical Center in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Enjoy what we have for you today.
Safari kashinda dhawari nitazungumza naye vipi na babu wataridhia siku ya ndoa shera wiki mie kanzu na tabia tumeshinda vizingiti wamea mtutishi maneno yenu chafu yeye sabuni mie jiki mtasubiri mazishi sisi bado tunaishi utamu wa walinazi ule na parachichi ai mwali wangu chikitu wendi wetu nu yangu chikitu mbeba siri zangu chikitu mwenye tamu yangu chikitu ai mama chikitu tumetoka far away chikitu wache wangu chikitu maneno ya msijali chikitu peke 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 I dedicate
Chiquito, un degue wangu wa thamani Chiquito your body, baby, kate vina. Shakupenda siku jui ata jina. Muka kupa body, wala somu china. Akika nita ikatia bima, eh. Way you move your body, baby, kate vina. Shakupenda siku jui ata jina. Muka kupa body, wala somu china. Akika nita ikatia bima, eh. For my inner mind, nobody got me like you do. Be nobody dancing like you do. I know you call me lazy, lover boy. When I run off, I run back to you, my queen. Cause I never want to lose you to anyone. Nakupenda sana. Do it all. In my life, you be order. And in my dreams, I they call on you, order. Nobody fi understand. Nobody fi understand. I say, in my life, you be harder. In my dream, I dey call on you, adore, yada. Say, make I tell you something. Ah, I'm a licha, I'm a licha, I'm a licha. Go down, down, I'm a licha. Go down, down, I'm a licha. One more time, I say, I'm a licha, I'm a licha, I'm a licha. Baby, go down, down, I'm a licha. Go down, down, on my nature.
Ça va, ça vient, ça va, ça vient, ça va. see mama, me feeling no normal. I just wanna be the reason why they call you mama. Yeah, no drama, why you make me stammer? Short conversation, no long grammar. Excuse me, sexy mama, what's the plan for this summer? Lagos, Kampala, Ghana, Panama. When it seems so hard, I'm a making scammer. Still keep it bad like Tony Montana. Me, I lose up my mind when you grind slowly.
And that was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, what the people think cannot be denied. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.